Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And happy afternoon, everybody. Welcome to another live edition of Midrats. I'm the aforementioned Sal, along with my ever-genial co-host, Eagle One of Eagle Speak. As we are live today, I'd like to extend an invitation for those that are so inclined. If you scroll to the bottom of the show page, you'll find a link to the chat room. And if there are some observations that you'd like to make during the course of the show, or if there is a question you would like for us to direct to our guests in the next hour, that's a great place to put it. And if you got a runoff and you want to catch up on what you missed for today's show, or to listen to some previous shows, remember, you can always get the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio, or you can just take a shortcut and subscribe to the free podcast over on iTunes, Stitcher, or any of your other aggregators? Anyway, let's go ahead and get on with today's show. And the joys of live radio, you can only do one take. Today, we're going to focus on the thing of nightmares, at least if you're on a ship. And that is anti-ship cruise missiles and anti-ship ballistic missiles. And we have, as our guest today, a guy that's been blogging as long as my co-host and I have. And we've had a pleasure over many years to talk about a variety of subjects with him. And that would be Steeljaw Scribe. He's a retired Navy captain with multiple operational tours, including command of VAW-122, the Steeljaws. He managed to rack up 3,500 hours riding in the back of an E-2C Hawkeye as a naval flight officer. He also has a good appreciation for big things needing to move. He was a navigator on the USS Dwight D. Eisenhower, CVN-69. When he wasn't flying around in circles, he was did some time over the Navy Postgraduate School in Monterey, where he got a master with honors in national security studies with a specialization or a focus on Russia. He's done multiple joint tours as a recidivist in operational and tactical intelligence, collection management, strategy, and policy. After retirement, he's continued to work in industry, first in ballistic missile defense, supporting the Missile Defense Agency, and then helping establish the Navy Air and Missile Defense Command over in Dahlgren, Virginia. That has become the Navy's premier center for all things associated with ballistic and fleet air defense. And it became the IAMD Division Dahlgren of the Surface and Mine Warfighting Development Center. Another acronym for you, SMWDC, back in 2015. And that is where he works today. In his spare time, he's as an honors graduate of the Naval War College. He's also teaches two of the three JPME-1 courses as a fleet seminar program professor and is a published author. And as one would expect, he's here today as an individual. His opinions are his own and not necessarily those of the United States Navy or any organizations that he is associated with. Steeljaw Scribe, welcome back to Midrat.
Hey, guys. Thanks. It's really great to be back. Happy New Year. And again, belated congratulations on 9 years of Blog Talk Radio. That's really outstanding.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. To kind of get, and I'm going to tease this because we're all gentlemen of a certain age, but what are the things that I found darkly humorous? Because we all, in one way or another, I know I'm the pup of the three of us, but we're all old enough to remember the Cold War. And there are a lot of people who didn't forget the Soviets and then watch the Russians recover from the disintegration of the Soviet Empire. And when the Russians took over Crimea, there was a couple of dark jokes about some slightly musty-smelling, gray-haired people wandered around the Pentagon trying to show people their, yellowed and faded Harvard graphic printouts of what the Soviet Union had. And but they're not laughing too much now. And it folded in with our guest, Dr. Dmitry Gorenberg, we had back in the fall. He talked about over at CNA for a while, he was the Russia cell. And now they have upwards to 20. And with today's topic, anybody who pays attention to the defense press or all the maritime or navalist-related publications knows that as we've started to talk about peer and near-peer competitors, that the old boogeyman has broken above the background noise. That's the anti-ship cruise missile and of course, the anti-ship ballistic missile that's got some people working their worry beads the last few years. And Steele Dill, I just wanted to roll to you because you've been so close to it, not only in your active duty years, but also post-retirement, is whether it's in the last 5 years or 10 years, when did you start to feel the ground shift and pivot to focusing back on these really challenging problems that even the most basic anti-ship cruise missile can prevent? And was there any one catalyst, or do you think it was just a steady series of events that broke it above the background noise?
Well, I can first off, with regards to the yellowing Harvard graphics and the musty odors, thank you for describing my travails across the Pentagon and other places the middle part of the last decade. We have a deal where when I say, well, back in the Cold War, one of my fellow workers queues up the flight of the dinosaurs, and we have a charge jar that every time I say I wish I had a Tomcat, I'm gonna have to start pitching a quarter into. But I would say it was probably in the late part of the first decade of the 2000s. Particularly as China started to assert itself, and we started paying more and more attention to the Chinese threat provided by both PLAN and the PLAF in terms of cruise missiles numbers. And it really hasn't been there are still doubters. Let me put it this way. There are still doubters about Russia. People who will say, oh, well, you know, the Russians, you know, they're pretty much out of it. They don't have the capacity anymore, et cetera, et cetera. Well, true. The days of the regimental size backfire raid coming over the horizon with 100 backfires is gone. But just recently, the Tu-22M3M upgraded backfire took flight for the first time, and there's some very interesting things with that aircraft to take a look at, particularly when you look at the electronics that are part of the upgraded package and the upgraded AS-4 that's going to be coming with it. Putin himself has also said that they plan to be launching the Kinzhal missile from that platform. Kinzhal, you recall, is the air-launched ballistic missile that the MiG-31K carries. And that illustrates an interesting direction that the Russians have been taking. There are a number of niche weapons that are cool. I mean, think about it. MiG-31K is, you know, big damn fighter in and of itself with these big sewer pipe engines. And it's just kind of a raw, you know, embodiment of the Russian approach to raw power. And it goes hauling off something the size of a short-range ballistic missile to shoot as an air-launched ballistic missile. That's a pretty interesting setup there. Other things, the SSN-27s and the SSN-26, the 26 Onyx for the domestic version, or the Akant that we see exported. India's version for the BrahMos. So you've got this newer generation missile that is starting to see export to places like Vietnam. India again, its own versions. China with the SSN-27 and building its own variations of it. So there's a lot of movement that started to get folks concerned, I would say, probably in the latter part of the first decade, and now that has grown in the teens.
One of the
Go ahead.
I was going to say, one of the challenges for some of these, we need to talk about guidance systems just briefly. Some of these things are not they're over the horizon. How are they? You know, what is the is it satellite guidance? What are we looking at here for some of these missiles?
Well, the truth of the matter is that each one of them is, whether we're talking Russian or Chinese, is supported by an extensive ISR and T, intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, and tracking system. The Russians first rolled this out in the designed it in the late 1960s, deployed it in 1972. It's the Theater Reconnaissance Strike Complex. And what the TRS does is it brings together into a single loop sensors, both primarily offboard sensors, shooters, surface, subsurface, and air, and a command and control network that coordinates this all for a directed time on target, single time on target. And originally, it was designed to nail the aircraft carriers before they got to their maximum range launch points. Well, when you look at what China has done with its advanced sea denial system, we don't call it A2AD anymore, it is basically the original theater strike complex, maybe a little bit on steroids in terms of numbers and supporting systems, but it's the same concept. And the Russians are going forward with the, I would say, probably version 2.0 of their reconnaissance strike complex. For the missiles themselves, then, that means that you can launch those from outside of, say, the missile seekers' range, using pre-coordinated or pre-targeted coordinates, GPS and/or internal inertial navigation systems to navigate to a point where it then turns the seeker on, and then it takes on its own, using its own logic to find the target. They want to play from a defensive standpoint the away game as much as we want to play the away game, and to do that requires a fairly extensive network of overhead systems, but also land-based over-the-horizon radars, maritime patrol aircraft, a variety of other special mission aircraft. Just an extensive network of surveillance systems, even AIS, automated information systems, identification systems that ship squawk, that folds in as well.
Looking on the blue or the friendly side of the house, though, I think you can make an argument that a lot of the systems that we call friendly and blue are owned by some people that probably don't wish us well, and they might become red sometime. But when you look back at, you know, anti-ship cruise missile development, at least in the West, I know Harpoon, the Navy started looking at it about the time that I was born, so in the mid-60s, but it really got a boost after 1967 when the Egyptians took out a Port Said with a couple of Colmars and took out the Israeli destroyer Eilat back in 67. And then by the late 70s, the Harpoon was deployed to the fleet in its first version. And I know in the last couple of years, we've looked at, you know, at the Norwegians have a nice new missile. We have an advanced anti-ship cruise missile we're developing ourselves. But with us and our NATO allies, what's your view on the state of blue offensive anti-ship cruise missile development?
Well, it could be a lot better than it is. What you have to remember are a couple of things. You can't do a straight one-to-one comparison. There are things that we have significant advantages in that Red dearly wishes for and is striving to attain, but is some time and distance away from acquiring. So they have to make up with other things. So, for example, let me go back to the Cold War and do a comparison. So we didn't have the backfire supersonic medium range bomber that carried a supersonic mid range anti ship cruise missile, the AS-4. We didn't need to because we had aircraft carriers with useful air wings that I could pull together on relatively short notice and conduct a war at sea exercise. And whenever, as a bonus, if I had B-52Gs from Griffiths Air Force Base that showed up loaded for bear with a dozen or so harpoons, oh, God, we were going to have a party. So we had aircraft carriers and they didn't. We had a flexible air wing that could conduct port sea strikes across a broad ocean area, and they didn't. But they had a singular target that they had to that they could focus on, the aircraft carrier battle group. We had a much broader target base that we had to address and take care of, as we talk about taking command of the seas and exercising local or general sea control. So that's one big difference there. If you go back to that Israeli-Egyptian set to in 1967, however, there are some interesting things that come out of that I think ought to serve as maybe a model for Western navies to take a look at. The Israeli Navy basically reinvented itself after the sinking of the Elat. The CNO that came in was a non-general warfare. He was not a typical SWO. He was a special warfare guy and said, we are going to move towards smaller, more maneuverable craft that we'll deploy our own indigenously developed cruise missile. We're going to utilize a blend of maneuver, tactics, electromagnetic warfare, and kinetic warfare. Bring all three of them together. And in 1973, in the Yom Kippur War, exercised that approach very effectively in two nights, basically, taking out one night the Syrian Navy in the battle off of Latakia, and then two nights later off of Damietta in Egypt, putting a major league hurt on the Egyptian Navy, such that the Israelis basically gained local sea control for the rest of the Yom Kippur War. That is something that we have to work on today. I will say I'm not satisfied personally with what I see our current state of play is for electronic warfare and maneuver in the electromagnetic domain. We have to become as familiar and comfortable with electromagnetic maneuver as we are with physical maneuver. There's a lot we can do with the combination of the two that people that look at one-dimensional charts with blood red keep out areas because of a bunch of missiles and surveillance and say, oh, we can't put a carrier in there. We can't put surface forces into there. We have to pull back and either let the Air Force kick the door down for us or turn into a Navy that's nothing but submarines. Those are people that do not understand the inherent maneuverability of naval forces. So how's that for a start?
Well, that's a good place to start because most has a SWO. The
the frightening prospect has always been that scene from Red Storm Rising, where you go Winchester fighting antique weapons, and then the new stuff actually shows up.
Yep.
Is that scenario? I mean, that was a scenario when the Russians, as you said, the 100 backfires coming over the horizon. But is that scenario possible today? Is there a? I mean, is Chinese capable of that kind of force generation, or is it that the current missile systems we face are so much more accurate given the command and control systems they have that's a whole different ball of wax?
Well, it comes down to how many missiles can you put in the air and what are you going to shoot? And our mantra back in 81 was kill the archer, not the arrow. If I can nail that backfire that may be carrying one or two AS-4s, those are AS-4s now that the ships down the force don't have to bother with. If I can kill that big, fat, slow H-6 Badger flying out, that nice big RCS target, yeah, he may be carrying several cruise missiles. But if I nail him, those are cruise missiles that we'll never see the light of day. And that goes, it bespeaks a requirement that we have to get back to thinking beyond the last 25 miles and the last 40,000 feet. That little bubble that we keep thinking about kinematically killing things within. Because at that point, it's purely defensive. And yeah, it's going to look quickly like Custer, Red Storm Rising.
And that's a lead-in of one of the things that, you know, even back during the Cold War always got my attention. The Russians and the Chinese and a few other nations that have bought their kit, they really have something that we don't have. Incredibly fast missiles. And defending yourself, the math gets really ugly really fast once, like you said, once that leaves the carrying aircraft, you have a completely different challenge on their hands. In addition to some of the legacy systems that I think we always need to be careful about because that's what we have too, what are some of the developments that potential adversaries or people who would want to keep us away from their shores have that kind of gives your eye a twitch?
Well, the one that particularly is of concern to me is what we've seen the Russians have been doing with TAC Air in the littorals. There's and you can find this on YouTube. If you just go and do a search on Russia, Caspian Sea, and 2018, there's a very interesting exercise that leads into, I believe, the Vostok 2018 later in 2018. In just a couple of quick elements on that video that you'll see. You'll see a command post ashore with a senior flag officer in charge. You will see a corvette-sized vessel, something that's roughly around the size of the old Grisha, maybe slightly larger, but with the command and control suite that would be the envy of a destroyer. That is apparently controlling Russian Federation Aerospace Force aircraft, Su-34s, Su-24 Fencers, even Su-25 Frogfoots. So when was the last time that we had an A-10 come out and participate in anti-surface unit warfare tactics? I'll save you the time on that one. We haven't. We're looking at the fruits of the post-2008 Georgian War reform that have been instituted across the Russian military. And we see integration, joint integration of forces, naval forces, evidently controlling aerospace forces, engaged in anti-surface unit warfare. And when you think about, well, what do they bring to the table? A variety of things. There's some old, some new. AS-17s, you know, a big, fast, short-range missile, but it can make make for a bad day for you. Up to the you know, relatively new Ka-35U, and the Ka-35U brings some interesting points to bear. Sal, I think you mentioned that our erstwhile peer opponents have fast missiles. Yeah, they do, but you know, the vast majority of cruise missiles that are out there are subsonic. And the Ka-35U itself is subsonic, but it's a nasty little missile. It's a sea skimmer, and it can give you real fits if you're not paying attention. I mean, as you go around the globe, there are any one of a number of countries that are still employing the 50-year-old missile, plus 50-year-old plus missile, the Styx missile. We've seen that employed in a couple of regions. We've seen Charlie 704s and other subsonics used by insurgent forces in the Red Sea area. Tankers, corvettes, frigates that have been attacked by those, by even small boats with cruise missile warheads in them. It's a wild environment that's out there. And the one thing I will give to the surface forces today that we did not have to worry about, back in our day, all we had to worry about was just the Russians. Today, you've got Russians, you've got Chinese, you've got Iranians, you've got Houthis. You know, pick a spot in the world, and you're going to find somewhere in there that there's going to be some cruise missiles, either ashore or afloat. Even as the Brits found out with the Falklands, sometimes you find Allies missiles being used against you.
Well, I keep going back to Wayne Hughes, who has been worrying about the effect of the spread of these cruise missiles by both state and non-state actors in the close-in areas, and the also the risk we face is sticking too much stuff on too few ships, I guess because we can. But doesn't this? I mean, this just opens us up to a huge amount of risk since the like Hezbollah attacked the. I guess I thought it was a C-802 or 801 that they used to attack that small Israeli ship back. Back in 2006, I think it was.
Yeah, Honey's. Yeah, pretty. Actually, it was a pretty decent sized ship. But you know what? Just like the Alat, the Honey was, let's just say, not combat ready at that point in time. When you come back to how you train, that when you are in a hostile environment, that you are aware not only on the bridge and in CDC, but even down to the mess decks, that you understand that your entire crew understands OPSEC and OPDEC, because both of them require the participation of all hands, that you do not fall into a Groundhog Day routine where it's, okay, day 47 of the same damn patch of ocean as a single unit doing presence operations. You need to be aware that as you are watching the wildlife is watching you. And as you are developing patterns of operation they are watching for your patterns of operation. When the Egyptians sank the Alat, they brought together weeks' worth of observations of the Alat's operation. And they noticed that she basically sailed to the same point, made the same turn off of Port Said at the same time, and folded that into the basis of their attack planning. Do not be predictable. Do not make yourself a predictable, easy target. Don't sit at one point and just radiate your powerful radar because somebody over the horizon is going to be tracking you. This brings up maneuver again and an opportunity to sort of underscore something here. 1981, when we went north for Ocean Venture, Ocean Safari, Magic Sword North, and I would do a quick plug here for John Lehman's new book, Oceans Ventured, Winning the Cold War at Sea. I just started this. It's a great read, and a lot of the stuff that we're talking about here is going to be is incorporated in there. It's a it's kind of cool to read about something that you were actually a part of. You and I, you know, us Cold Warriors, this almost seems like second nature. But you have to remember that the JOs, even the department heads, and to extent some of the COs, this is new to them. Their reality is a unopposed environment where you announce that you're sailing from Jacksonville or Norfolk or San Diego. You take a great circle route to your missile box where you lob TLAMs or F-18s at an enemy that doesn't really have much in the way of a surface-to-air threat. And the biggest challenge there is, the wear and tear in the airframes on the 10, 12-hour missions to go do that. It was very different for us, and it was a much more dynamic environment and maneuver, both electromagnetic and physical, was utilized. That is something that we're working down at Dahlgren to reinstitute and rebuild that kind of warfighting approach, and it's taking ground. It's finding some purchase there.
It's interesting. You mentioned the 2006 Hennet attack, because that attack off Lebanon is kind of one of my nightmares that I have. And I think with each passing year, this threat at least becomes more and more prevalent, where you have if you can park an RV in a garage, then you can park a mobile anti-ship cruise missile, and out of some neighborhood, somebody can open their garage door, sit out, and launch a missile. Incredibly threat, but even worse than that is one thing you just touched on. It has to do with a mindset. For instance, the IDF report, and you always got to give the Israelis some credit when they put their stuff out in public. They put themselves on report. They said that in addition to a lot of the other failures, that it was the way their forces understood the operative reality and then implemented that. They didn't think there was any potential missile threat, so the ship's anti-ship missile suite was disabled, put in a standby mode to save some energy while they just went back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And we've seen that mindset repeat itself throughout naval history, and it goes back to training. Mm-hmm. What are some of the steps that perhaps we've taken as a U.S. Navy, as this realization of this threat coming back has increased? Have we adjusted our training scenarios and our training tools so we're doing more than just theory? We're actually checking the equipment, make sure it responds as we expect.
Yeah, we have. going back to our experience with the Red Sea in October of 2016, there's a lot that came out of that, one of which a couple of things. So there's been a refocus on things like threat-centric planning, where you look at the area that you're going to be operating and you run a healthy assessment of what the threat is there, and then you build your doctrine off of that instead of trying to come across with something that fits all threats, all places, at all times. One of the big things the Red Sea taught us was that we have we've forgotten that the environment has a vote. I go back to my first encounter with the monsoon season in the Indian Ocean in 1980, seeing things like watching a B-52 completely disappear as it went under a layer, or the multiple time around echoes that we were getting a beautiful paint of the Indian coast from 600 nautical miles away. there are places. Every geographic location has its own unique aspects to it. Whether you look at the funnel aspect as you get down towards the Bab el Mandeb Straits and the Southern Red Sea, and you have mountains that come close to the shore that have that funneling effect on the radar and generate intense amounts of clutter, to ducting in the Eastern Mediterranean, it's present everywhere, and for some reason, as a service, we have kind of forgotten about that. Maybe, and I think part of that goes back to how we teach folks about radar. We have reinstituted some basic training en route to the ships. We have done things such as live fire with a purpose. The past were you set up a missile shot to make sure that you could hit the target, absolutely hit the target, that became the primary motivator rather than any kind of realistic training, has been turned around, and we're instituting scenarios that are much more realistic. And there have been other initiatives that are ongoing as well. We have a long ways to go, though. We have basically two decades worth of lax time that we have to – we've got to scrape a lot of barnacles off the hull. Let me just put it that way.
Yeah. It amazes me that we have to keep learning the same lessons over – and I mean, in 1972, off the coast of Vietnam, USS Higby gets bombed when a couple of MiG-17s hide themselves among the mountains, come in low. You know, I mean, it is not a scenario that is brand new. It's one we yeah. should be aware of. I mean, and there were other aspects to that attack. Some other things were going on at the same time. But yeah, I mean, that was golly, that was a long time ago.
Well,
of course, I was. And I was there.
Look at some of the commonalities between the Alat, the Stark, the Sheffield, the Honey. There's some common threads running through there. One of the common threads is you're in a hostile environment, but you've become inured to the threat. Oh, that contact that just turned south. Yeah, that's. You know, they're going to go target somebody else, you know, kind of a deal. That it wouldn't dawn on you that, hey, they've just turned inbound. This is, you know, they've shown a proclivity for shooting anything on their nose. I'm on their nose. General quarters, air raid. You know, we just... it seems like that needs to be reemphasized about every generation or so.
Let me throw out a question about electronic control of the electronic spectrum. When I was a young officer, we spent a lot of time
AMCON. We spent a lot of time training to do things without, you know, blasting electronic emissions everywhere. Is this another one of the lost arts that we need to get back to?
It is, and we are working our way back towards that. But there's more to it now than just turning things off. You've got to be smart about what kind of a profile that you apply. Just as when we did Ocean Venture, and we put the trailers on the cruisers and sent them one way while the carrier went the other way, and it worked big time. Well, the degree of sophistication has grown since then. And so you have to be much more savvy as to how and when you apply electronics and what kind of a profile that you want to show or not show.
You look at any type of anti-ship cruise missile or even anti-ship ballistic missile this plays with as well. I guess if you're a designer of one, not just when you're looking at the threat, you know, there's always a trade-off between speed, range, what type of seeker head it's going to have, what its flight profile have. And I was curious, how do you rank those speed, range, seeker, flight profile, and Do we have a difference? First of all, does the Navy have a different priority than you have? And what do you think the Chinese and the Russians seem to value based upon what they're buying?
Well, certainly, I think both feel that there is something to be had with ASBMs. I would note that the Russians were the first with, I think, was it the Sawfly? But that had a nuke warhead in it, so all you had to do was just get in the general vicinity. The deal is that missile design in one form or another is always a collection of compromises. And those compromises reflect what do you think of the three operational planning factors. Factor time, factor space, factor force that you can deal with. And of those three operational planning factors, only one of them you cannot gain back, and that's time. So if you have a weapon system that can offer you that ability to address operational factor time, particularly in areas like the Pacific where you have large distances to cover, you're probably going to work to that end. And that is what I would say is probably the biggest thing with ASBMs, is that they change the timetable that you have to work with. You know, we would get notification that backfires were launching, and you could, okay, backfire is launching, go ahead, start the clock, and you had a timeline that you'd go ahead, start launching get the E2s out there, get the fighters out there, and get the grids. And by the time that they got to where you were or into your general vicinity, you had the grids set up, and you could give them a nice warm welcome. Now, of course, the closer that you got to the beach, the shorter that timeline began. That's when they started looking at things like vest fjord ops and the like to try and take advantage of some of the shortcomings, some of the compromises that were in the backfire AS4 weapon system. And so without going into details, I would just say that ASBMs have compromises that can be addressed. Period. I will have to leave it at that.
Yeah, I keep thinking. I look at the language of mine warfare and the language of the missile threat, say from the Chinese, very similar. You know, you don't have to have an actual mind to make surface warfare officers go nuts. You just have to have the threat of a mind. And mm-hmm. How much of the missile threat scenario is of a similar nature, where we I don't want to say we panic, but we are certainly more concerned than we need to be, and we just need to keep plodding along to find solutions to the problems? Or is this a dramatic change in how far our distances offshore need to become for us to operate?
So I would say that first you have to put Hollywood aside. Quit looking at the movies and quit looking at how Hollywood has these, you know, magic missiles that always seem to find the target. And that means that you have to have a more realistic approach to the intelligence that you're getting on the systems, a much more integrated, an operationalized approach, if you will, to intelligence, that you acknowledge the strengths, but you focus on exploiting the weaknesses of the system. And that's a challenge. It's always, you always have that question on the intel side of the house. How much do we know? How much is of what we know is complete as regards a particular weapon system? We have two adversaries that are very familiar with our collection systems, and so it's that ongoing cat and mouse game, if you will. But all that said, there is no room for complacency. There needs to be an understanding, and I think that there is a growing awareness in the brainstem of the fleet that, hey, you know, there's this threat out there, and we need to start turning to and addressing it. From a material standpoint, you're always going to get industry and the folks inside the Beltway with their PowerPoint weapon systems that say, oh, yeah, I got a solution for you. And, you know, humma, 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 2027, humma, humma, humma. Well, yeah, that's great. Okay. Talk to me about what we can do right now. Well, how much chaff is out there? How much what do we have in the way of countermeasures that can be employed against not just the shiny objects, but this plethora of first-generation stuff out there? You know, the Styx missile has a glass jaw where jamming is concerned. The Israelis found that and exploited it at Latakia. They exploited it with electromagnetic measures and with maneuver. You know, one of the saws that we hear today is that, oh, my God, you know, our cruise missiles were short-stick. You know, I mean, they have much longer-range missiles, and, you know, they can fire them at us long before we can get in closer and fire ours. Well, you know what? At Latakia, you had the Styx missile with a 25 nautical mile range and the Gabriel missile with a 16 nautical mile range. So you know what the Israelis did? They got the Syrians to come out and use their Soviet trained tactics, which was basically a salvo of all the missiles so that, you know, you had numbers in the air. And then the Israelis, once the Syrians salvoed, the Israelis employed maneuver and speed. This was also nighttime. Maneuver and speed and jamming and chaff. And you know what? None of those Styx missiles found their mark. And closing at fast speed, to 16 nautical miles, they launched their Gabriels. 65% of the Gabriels found their target. And the remaining ships that didn't get hit with the missiles, well, they closed to gun range and shot them in the face. Good old-fashioned naval gunfire. But it was a combination of maneuver, soft kill, and hard kill. And it's the... We've been focusing so much all the way back to, if you will, the Rings of Steel with the kamikazes on the hard kill that a lot of times we forget about what soft kill and maneuver tactics can offer us. That has been sort of my my mission and the folks that I work with, their mission as well, is to work very hard on addressing all aspects, soft kill, hard kill, maneuver.
Perhaps deviate a little bit from the topic, but really not that much. I wanted to tap into your airborne early warning knowledge because, you know, obviously when it comes to aircraft carriers, U.S. Navy is the big kid on the block by far. And we have the E-2, and especially the E-2 Delta, it's a nice piece of kit, to make an understatement. Mm-hmm. Of course, the French fly the Hawkeye off of their one carrier. But we also mm-hmm. have the Chinese, the Russians, and the British. So the British have a rotary wing airborne early warning. They have their mm-hmm. their carriers out there without that capability. And you know, put yourself in Chinese, Russian, or even in British boots, and you've got a carrier way, way far away from home. What do you do to compensate for the lack of that little paradise that U.S. carriers have circling overhead?
Well, if I'm the Chinese, I'm probably using my carrier for something other than over-the-horizon power projection. There's some – just like the original mission for the Kuznetsov was more an ability to fill a gap at sea with fighters. When you look at the carriers themselves, whether it's the Liaoning or the Kuznetsov, without catapults, you're limiting the ability of your air wing to carry meaningful ordnance over the horizon. With the Brits, I would argue the same thing. I still can't believe that they made the decision to not build catapults on the QE. Although at least they've mitigated some of the problem with the AEW with the new Crow's Nest EH-101 Merlin approach. And that is something I would like to take a minute to address here. So, yeah, we have E-2s deployed with the carrier, but you know what happens when you get a carrier in theater? Units are disaggregated. So the carrier, say, goes on to the Persian Gulf and leaves a Burt-class DDG by itself in the Red Sea. What do you do for an overhead sensor? Yeah. Exactly.
Things get real quiet real fast.
Exactly. I think the time has come that we need to look very hard at employing some kind of an AEW kit for our disaggregated forces. And I would say that one of the first things to start looking at is the what the Brits are doing for the Crow's Nest system for their carrier. See if that can be something that could be applied to an H-60 or, you know, maybe whatever the next generation following the H-60 is going to do. But we absolutely must get overhead systems, an airborne sensor for disaggregated ships. The lessons of history.
Yeah, I was going to say, here we go again. I mean, I thought the Russians had that for the over-the-horizon targeting using some of their helos back in the day.
Well, that's different, though. That kind of radar system that the Hormone Bravo had was very focused for surface contacts. I'm talking about something that you don't need a 250 to 350 nautical mile system. If you can just take and expand that 25 mile radar horizon out to, say, 65 nautical miles, you've just bought yourself some precious battle space, some precious depth of fire, so that you can see, perhaps, those land-based attack air that are using terrain masking to mask their approach to the ship. I still remain flabbergasted that we, with all the lessons that we have seen out there, everything that has happened to disaggregated vessels, that's still not on the list of things to do.
Yeah, that feeds into another nightmare scenario of mine. And it was really disappointed for me, for some of the people who did this. And I guess it goes back to, you know, who do you have in the room that one, knows how to look at a chart, and two, knows their business. But in the last few months, we've seen, again, people who should know better, who are coming up with, to me, were just professionally incompetent ideas about show of force in the Sea of Azov and the Black Sea by either the U.S. Navy or somebody else.
Yeah.
And when I whip out my trusty, rusty circular slide rule and start to look at some of the math there, that is a nightmare environment. Sea of Azov is the size of one of the smaller of the Great Lakes, and the Black Sea is just a bathtub. Talk a little bit about, for the listeners out there who maybe hadn't had a chance to really think about what some people are asking the Navy to do, talk a little bit about that tough conversation. If somebody asked you, okay, what's the danger of my two DDGs headed up to the northeast near the Crimean Peninsula?
Well, certainly a map at hand would be the first tool to go to and start talking to it, but also a healthy understanding of just what kind of forces that you're going to be facing. And I refer back to that YouTube video. That is a prime example of what you're going to be looking at. If you try and shove a couple of, say, destroyers up into the up towards the Sea of Azov, you have a large landmass that is on at least three quarter sides of you that is hostile, that has access to a large force of modern generation, what the Russians call generation 4++ fighters. When you look at the Su-34, the Su-30SM, which is flown by both Russian Federation Aerospace Forces, but more importantly, the Su-30SM is also flown by naval aviation units that have given up their Su-24 fencers. Things like the Black Sea Fleet, for example. So these are guys whose livelihood is finding ships and attacking them with now modern aircraft. These ain't Badgers anymore. So you have that multidimensional aspect that just the air threat alone provides. You have this new generation of frigates, corvettes, smaller vessels that are prime for operating in the inland seas, Baltic, Black Sea, that have 8-cell VLS launchers that carry a variety of anti-ship and land attack cruise missiles in them. They're the sort of thing that you look at and go, well, why the hell didn't we put something like that on the LCS? You know? To pick a scab.
Low-hanging fruit.
Yeah, I mean, yes, it is. It is. It requires a discussion of forces, command and control for those forces and how they've exercised and putting it into an operational framework. And then hopefully enlightenment follows.
Well, yeah, let's talk some more about the shortcomings of the LCS. No, actually, we've taken up an hour of your time, Steel Joe. I think we really ought to let you go watch the Eagles play the Saints. And
oh God, and, is it any better than that abortion was up at Foxborough?
Eagles fans tend to be scary. I'm going to be careful what I say.
Well, I'm a long-suffering 49er fan, so we'll be there. We'll be back again. We're like the Russians. We'll be back.
Well, speaking of back, we got to have you back on again more than this. It's been a few years, but time flies, and you're having fun. You're getting old, I guess. Obviously, for our listeners.
Hey, season, not old.
Obviously, if our listeners are on Twitter, they can follow you at SteeljawScribe there as well. Talk for a little bit about some things that have got your interest, maybe or maybe not, involving anti-ship cruise missiles and stuff like that. And if you're going to give our listeners advice, one thing to put on their automated Google alert system, what topic would that be this year?
I would say Chinese or Russian military exercises, because that will then capture a variety of single service or multi-service exercises. And let me think if there's anything else here. There's some platforms that are coming down the line. China has the Renhai Super DDG, I call it a cruiser, coming along. But you know what? That's their first multi-mission platform, and that's going to require integration of a variety of weapon systems that have a variety of missions. And all you have to do is go look at our own Aegis Baseline series to see that even after 40 years, we're still working on that integration aspect. I don't wish them luck. So you got the Renhai coming down the pike. The interesting thing on the Russian side is that you're not going to see any big surface combatants, new combatants. There's a couple that are still in various stages of rebuild. One of the last of the Kirovs, I think I saw today, was supposed to be out to sea by 2020. There was a recent Russian TV broadcast where they were walking around on board this particular one, the Nakhmayev, and there was a tree. No kidding, not a decoration, but there was a tree growing up between the planks up forward on the vessel, that it had seated itself and just started growing.
Yeah, that's never a good sign.
Yeah. Yes. I thought it was kind of metaphorical myself.
It's kind of a pre-plank owners.
Yeah. on the aviation side. Keep an eye on the upgraded backfire. That production and the new production TU-160 Blackjacks and the refitted ones that are coming out. Generation 5 fighters are having issues both in China and Russia. They're finding out engine issues just like we did and a variety of other things. So emphasis is going to continue to be on Generation 4++. Which are very, very capable aircraft in and of their own right. So yeah, it's a robust environment that we're going to be facing over the next 10 to 15 years.
Well, we look forward to keeping track of you and talking to you again in the future. I hope you have a great 2019 there, shipmate.
Thanks a lot, guys. I really appreciate it. Look forward to coming back again soon.
Oh, please do. Thanks again for coming on today.
Okay.
And thanks, everybody. And thanks, everybody, for joining us for another edition of Mid-Rats. Until next time, hope you have a great Navy day. Cheers.